Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Philip Beverly, Pat Brady, Patrick Cotter, and Mike Miller. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Nice to have you with us, where our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you want to tweet us a comment, it's @Dumo. And again, the program live tonight, audio and video, coast to coast, and border to border, and around the world on the World Wide Web. I want to talk about a very disturbing story that dominated much of the Sunday morning shows today. And this is a report that ISIS has issued a hit list, if you will, for the families of U.S. servicemen. They have published their addresses. They've called for family members to be beheaded. And it is one of the most dastardly reports that we have heard about the actions of ISIS, which are already basically in a level beyond the pale. Philip Beverly, you have a reaction to this story. You were a U.S. Air Force veteran yourself, but your reaction to this story?
I'm horrified. This goes way beyond the pale, and I think whatever it takes to destroy ISIS at this point, that's what we need to do. There should be no holds barred at this point. You're putting family members of servicemen in jeopardy, and that's not on. That's
Mike Miller.
Not acceptable.
I agree with Phil. Hard to believe when I talk to people that find this hard to believe that there are actually rules of war, and they violate everything. They don't come anywhere near what is considered civilization, so they don't need to be treated civilly.
Patrick Cotter, reaction from you, and also I want to kind of expand the question, is that much of this information is readily available in social media, and it raises the issue that a lot of people don't really consider, and that is social media shares an awful lot with people that you don't want to share things with.
Right. I mean, this is a great example of the horror that is ISIS, because they combine the barbarity of really pre-civilization criminals, just horrible, the most barbaric people you can imagine, with a sophisticated understanding of the web and how they can mine it for information, how they can use it for propaganda purposes. It is really the perfect storm of terror.
Pat Brady, a Republican tonight. Pat, your reaction?
I agree with what everybody said. I just hope at some point from the White House we get some kind of plan on how to deal with them. We have been dealing with this for 2 years now, and we really haven't seen a strategy to do just what Philip said. We got to destroy them. We need to engage the public, say what we're going to do and why we're going to do it, and do it. We've been messing around with this for so long, it's getting to a point where they feel emboldened to do stuff like this.
Do you believe that, you know, we've heard so much about the war weariness of the American people? We've heard so much about the term, troops of feet on the ground, that people don't want troops on the ground in faraway places. Is an incident like this, is something as dastardly as this, does it have to take some act of terror against the family of an American serviceman or woman to rile up the American people to say, by golly, basically what you said, Philip, we're going to go anywhere and do anything we possibly can, and forget all these caveats that we're not going to put troops on the ground. We're not going to do these things. I mean, all bets off. Is that what it's going to take? Do we need another emotional event like a 9/11 to rile up the American people to demand an end to this?
I don't know at this point. I know that the conventional sort of boots on the ground approach isn't going to work here. Because it's asymmetric warfare. We need to be able to engage special forces and our intelligence community in a way that we can precisely eliminate and decapitate their leadership and then eliminate their fighting force. The other thing that we absolutely have to do is it costs money to do what they're doing. And I'm curious where they're getting the money from.
Oil.
And that money stream has to be cut off, and that's a non-military option that absolutely has to be engaged immediately.
You know, that's more of a strategy than I've heard from anybody in the last 2 years, which makes complete sense, and I think the American public would buy off on short of attack on the home soil. But we haven't heard that from the administration.
Well, I think, though, it's fair to note that this is not a conventional enemy. This is not a country. You use the phrase, they feel emboldened, so they feel to do it. To be blunt, you can't intimidate mad people. These are insane people. They're never going to be threatened out of being right. who they are. This is a new kind of war, and it's going to take a lot of – I agree with you. We need original thinking. We can't deal with them the way we've dealt with countries or even rogue states. So – It's got to be done, but I think it's understandable that we're struggling to find the right way.
Mike?
There's two aspects to it, though. In terms of war wariness, I always defend the homeland. I'm very nationalistic. But there's not a chance in the world that I would go and fight them without all the Arab nations right beside us doing a lot of the attacking, because we'll be nothing but attacked for killing more brown people. All we ever hear is how horrible we are, and we destroy people in the Middle East.
Well, we're getting more of that. Certainly Jordan and Egypt, and we're getting more and more of that support. I mean, they're buying into that, and part of one of the reasons why they're buying into it, they not only fear their own political system, but they also have seen, you know, the devastation in their own countries because of the terrorist attacks.
I agree, Ed, but I just want to see them. I want to see them shoulder to shoulder. The second piece is, one reason we can't win it as easily as you both were saying is because we refuse to do what we did in World War II to win. Now, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe we've become more civilized. But you think of what we did to Tokyo and to Dresden and so forth. We destroyed them, and we didn't care who we killed along the way. The bad people were somewhere we had to destroy them.
The problem is,
we could destroy them in ISIS. We could figure roughly where they are and simply destroy them.
Just kill everybody there.
That would be the side effect.
The problem is they're over hundreds and thousands of square miles, and you're talking about a genocide of a size that has never happened in history. It's not Tokyo. We can't bomb Dresden. We can't go and shoot them out of the skies.
What we can't do is lay down before we go in.
And of course not. But some of these people are in Minneapolis, and they're in Paris, and they're in London. They are everywhere. So this idea that we're going to send over the 8th Air Force and bomb them away is a fantasy.
But the idea that every time the president speaks, he gives something that we're not going to do. I agree with you. But to start out with, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do this. We actually have an opportunity to get the Arab states, the Israelis, mm-hmm. and us. We're all on the same page on this.
Yep.
And get a good coalition.
Well, also in this particular case, and that is, you know, there's so much coverage about the foreign fighters. The foreign fighters, some from Britain and some from English-speaking nations and some from the United States. An alarming number of people from the United States. They've gone to be trained. Some of them, the FBI and our intelligence agencies, they know where they are. But a lot of them, they don't know where they are. So they are in the midst. They could look at this social media hit list, and they could start acting on it. That's the next big shoe to fall in this war that I see.
And I'm a little bit more hopeful in terms of the foreign fighter angle, that our intelligence community is smart enough to have some assets on the ground that look like the foreign fighters but are actually giving us some good intel on how to decapitate them when the time comes?
Let's hope that is the case. 1-800-723-8289. Maybe decapitate wasn't the right word. probably not, but you can't take it back because we're live. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dupont.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton Los Angeles Universal City. At HiltonUniversal.com, they let you be the star in Hollywood.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and Mike Miller, during the break, you were sharing with the rest of the panel an interesting article that you recently read that you think the public should know a lot more about.
Yeah, that was the article by a guy named Graham Wood. It appears, I believe, in the Atlantic magazine. It's long, but it is worth your time. It really is worth your time. And he explains, which I've spent time in the Middle East. I do all my research on the country of Bahrain. And I know that what ISIS does is not Islam. It is not Islam of today. But it absolutely is Islam of the Middle Ages. It is Islam of 1400 and before and so forth. And their mindset is such that if we ignore the fact that they have this religious backing based upon Islam, a certain interpretation that is that old, then we're going to be at a disadvantage when it comes time to fight them. And just understanding that, I think, is important. So I get the president's point. He doesn't want to in any way attack Islam of today. But at the same time, you cannot deny the religious connection. It's a 400 or 500-year-old religious connection, but it is absolutely there, and it leads their decisions, their willingness to do the things they do, that they would make a deal, and you know that if you make a deal with an infidel, you don't have to keep up your side because the person with whom you've made a deal is an infidel. So you can't negotiate with these people because you know that they're never going to live up to what they say. So this is important.
Philip, do you agree with that?
I do, and I think we're sort of caught in this moral dilemma in our country, and I think we see it whenever there's drone strikes where there's collateral damage, meaning civilians, non-targets, are killed, and we do this hand-wringing about, oh, should we do this? And it's like, yeah, this is what happens in this kind of conflict. People are going to die. Muslims, Americans, Europeans, they're going to die until this threat is eliminated, full stop. You cannot negotiate with people who you live in different centuries. You cannot negotiate with them. So you have to put them down. The word that Patrick used, they're mad. Mad dogs have to be put down.
You know what's interesting?
That barbarity
as well.
Is just
okay. Well,
it really
but again,
does.
When you say mad dogs have to be put down, again, you are you're one of our Democratic liberal guests this evening, and I think that I think that's very important for people listening around the country that there are rational Democrats that understand that you're not all rolling over and agreeing that the president's policies are correct. Sometimes you got to get tough, and sometimes you've got to be brutal.
And the thing that I know about this president, having had opportunities to talk to him, he's very thoughtful. And in most instances, I believe that serves well. And there's some instances where direct action is a much better option. And he seems on occasion to be reluctant to go with the direct action.
Pat Brady, a question to a Republican question. Is it possible in a presidential campaign for a Republican candidate, and some have already suggested, Scott Walker being one, that the concept of boots on the ground, I think that Lindsey Graham has also expressed it, that the concept of boots on the ground is a viable thing to discuss and to debate, because perhaps that is an opportunity to bring the American people along, that although they are war-weary, that there's a job that still needs to be done, and Americans, men and women, have got to step up and continue to protect our way of life.
Yeah, I think absolutely you can, but you have to make the case. You can't just say boots on the ground, a la what we did 10 or 12 years ago. You need to make the case to the American people, explain, just like you have done, what these people are all about, why they're a threat to the United States, and this letter today goes a long way towards that, but you got to make the case.
Let's go to Austin, Texas. Rick is listening to us, and he's listening to us on KLBJ. And, Rick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call, gentlemen, and really love your show.
Thank you.
I'm a disabled vet, and I can tell you that the only thing these people truly understand or respect is force. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be able to debate them. You're not going to be able to talk them into being your friends. You're not going to get them to see a different way of thinking. And the only thing heck with boots on the ground, how about tanks on the ground? And put a couple of battalion M1 Abram tanks and some Apache helicopters, and you can corral these people to a point where we can take them out.
Rick, I want to ask you one follow-up question, then I want to get others that may have a question or comment based on what you've said. The story that we discussed at the beginning of the broadcast today, this hit list put out by ISIS targeting American military families, calling for them to be beheaded. You come out of the military background family. You've identified yourself. Thank you for serving this country. I appreciate it, as do everyone listening to this broadcast, I believe. And I'm very sorry to hear about the disability that you're suffering from as well. But when you read a story like that in the sphere of friends that you may have that come out of a military background, what goes through your mind as to how you and others can protect now yourself because you have defended or will be defending this country against foreign enemies?
Well, I can tell you that the mindset of the soldier, they have just awakened a sleeping dragon. The military is just biting at the chomps now. I mean, anybody that had any reservation they want to obliterate them. And I think they have, as the Japanese admiral, I think, once said, you know, just awoken a sleeping dragon.
Pat, your comment?
Yeah. You know, I absolutely appreciate and the sincerity of everybody's feelings on this issue are so evident. But I want to raise just maybe a counterintuitive thought. In our history, we've had to deal with some pretty horrific people. We've dealt with Nazis. We've dealt with the militarist in Japan. One of the things, though, we learned is that, yes, you have to be brutal to deal with those fanatics, those mad people. But there's a lot of other people that end up going along with these mad people. At least history suggests that that's what happens. And some of them are not all the way gone. I mean, when Germany was denazified, we spent several decades after that, successfully winning over the hearts and minds of the German people. The same thing happened in Japan. And I just raise this point because it does seem to me that, yes, there are the people who issued that list, the people who carry out these executions on video. Those are not people you can ever deal with. Those are not people you can ever negotiate with, has been made very clear by the other panelists. But I do think that when we see young kids from Western countries aligning themselves with these people, we have to think that there are people there that are aligned with ISIS that we may be able to reach. Kids who are growing up in London and Minneapolis who are ending up with these people, it seems to me, are not beyond hope. And I think that we may need at some point to recognize that because the ISIS is not going to conveniently group themselves together in the country of ISIS so that we can drop a huge bomb on them, we might be thinking of a two-lane strategy. One is the mad people have to be taken out. I don't see any other choice. But at the same time, there are all these thousands and thousands and maybe millions of sympathetic people in certain parts of this world that we have to find a way to reach. We have to stop them from getting on those planes and flying and joining this group of insane medieval terrorists.
Mike. What has been dispiriting is I believe that some of the actions by the Obama administration to try to fight ISIS in Syria and Iraq actually has been working. They've stopped the spread. But as we know, at least based upon their own actions, Boko Haram has said they're now in bed with ISIS. And supposedly those horrible attacks in Yemen are the work of ISIS. Now, that means this philosophy is beginning to spread in a way that becomes even harder. So the idea of bombing them becomes, which means the only solution to that is a Muslim solution. Mm-hmm. That's why El-Sisi's view that we have to sit down and almost have a reformation within the world of Islam to take our brothers, even of the same Sunni or Shia background, and say, unacceptable. We are going to kill you.
But you also, to speak to Patrick's point, it seems to me you have to have a strategy, and maybe a very expensive strategy, to deal with the sympathizers from Minneapolis. I mean, we all know that there have been many sympathizers that have come from the Minneapolis, Minnesota, you know, market. Yeah. And so how do you get to them and convince them?
Oh, boy, I wish I knew because, well, one thing we do is if they...
Rick, do you have a thought on that?
Well, again, I think it goes back to this aspect of showing strength. I think if these people saw that ISIS and those guys were up against a losing battle, that America had the resolve, if the world even had the resolve, but we got to take the lead in that, that we were going to wipe you out. Just like after 9/11, it was like, we don't care if you're a terrorist or not. If you even harbor terrorists, we're coming after you. And that, I mean, America was.
But Rick, what I'm trying to address here is the homegrown terrorist, whether they're part of ISIS or Al Qaeda or whatever. Let's put them under the brand of ISIS at the moment. Evildoers, as George Bush would say. You have them, and the question is, how do you reach them? It seems to me you have a combination of, there has to be extensive involvement by the intelligence community. There may have to be invasions of their privacy. There may have to be bending of the constitutional rights. These are things that I hate to say because I basically believe that Edward Snowden did the right thing, maybe for the wrong reasons, but I'm more pro Edward Snowden than most people, certainly in the mainstream media. And yet I fear that that if we don't do that, we're going to have a continuation and a growth amongst people who are disillusioned. These are young people. Many of them are wealthy, or they come from wealthy families, but they're disillusioned. And the disillusioned youth of the world are now fodder, especially in a social media age, they are fodder for ISIS and extending it and triggering the most antisocial aspects of their personalities. Thank you for your call. We'll be back with more in a moment from Chicago. Sick of wading through social media, papers, and nightly news to get your Chicago political scoop? Subscribe to AlderTrack instead. It's got a weekday newsletter with original reporting on all 50 aldermen, top city agencies, administrative commissions, their staff, and more. It's my go-to source for news, raw data, and council tidbits first thing in the morning. If you subscribe to AlderTrack.com before April 7th, you'll get 10% off. Get AlderTrack now, or you'll be missing out when the new council begins.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for the new Wild Travels series, Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
From Indianapolis to Istanbul, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. And around the table this evening, we've got great guests, and I'm going to let them introduce themselves and give us a little bit about their background. And we begin with Patrick Cotter.
Hi, Bruce. It's great to be here. I'm an attorney here in Chicago. I'm with a firm called Greensfelder. And I've been, in my past life, I was an attorney with the Department of Justice, Strikeforce, and Organized Crime back in New York. And I've been in private practice since, and I deal with issues of law, justice, crime, and misunderstandings with the government quite often.
And also, let me just add, part of your claim to fame is you were the lead guy that really made the case against John Gotti and sent him to prison.
I had...
I can say that. You're best.
I had two terrific partners, and we tried that case together, and it's the proudest moment in my professional life.
And you're alive to talk about it. Mike Miller.
I'm an associate professor of economics at DePaul. I've been there for 35 years, PhD from University of Pittsburgh. Do my research on the Fed and on the economy of Bahrain.
And Philip Beverly, you're next.
I'm an associate professor of political science down at Chicago State. I am, I would say, an ardent defender of the First Amendment in my job there, caught in a spot of bother right now.
And you practice it well.
I'm working diligently at it.
And Patrick Brady.
Principal and founder of Next Generation Group, former party chairman, former national committee member, politically active my entire life. But like Patrick, I was a former federal prosecutor, and probably the best job in the world when you're that age.
Absolutely. And in the second hour, we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But since we have two people who have the Justice Department in their background, I want to talk a little bit about Loretta Lynch. The president wants her to be the next attorney general. There's some question as to whether or not the votes are there. There certainly is a big question as to whether or not there's even going to be a vote, because it's tied into the politics of the U.S. Senate. But again, we have a unique situation that she came out of the same district where you worked. And
that's
you
right.
said before we went on the air, you met her on her first day working for the Justice Department. Tell us a little bit about who she is personally and maybe get into the political aspects of what's going on right now.
Sure. I remember Loretta because we had a habit in the Eastern District of New York where on your first day you walked around, you met all the other assistants, you would go to their offices and have a little couple minutes to say hello. So I remember Loretta, and she went on to have an absolutely sterling career in the Eastern District, and there's no question that Loretta is as qualified as anybody who's ever been nominated for that position. She is completely non-political. I can honestly say I knew her for several years. I have no idea what her political affiliation is, if she has one. She is a lawyer. She is a federal prosecutor. She is a servant of the people. And I really hope that I understand the politics and there are arguments to be made and points to be made on both sides. I get that. But there shouldn't be any controversy about her qualifications.
Pat Brady, you are one of the Republicans at the table this evening. Shouldn't any president get the attorney general that he or she wants?
Yeah, generally. I think part of it politically is a little payback maybe for what the Democrats did for so many years when they controlled the Senate. I think Loretta Lynch's problem is not Loretta Lynch, it's Eric Holder, who was the most political attorney general in my lifetime. And I think that's why the Republicans are probably doing a lot of what they're doing, because we did have a very, I think, political
attorney
general.
So then why don't they want to get rid of him tomorrow?
It's a good question. But it's,
because they love him so much.
It's caught up, well, I'm saying the confirmation process for her. But it's caught up in a lot of politics, which I don't like, and I think a lot of the people, Republicans in the Senate, don't particularly care for. But I think that's more the story than her
Philip Beverly.
It's bad optics for
is
them.
Is she going to be the next attorney general?
Probably with about 14 days left in the president's term at this rate. I mean, this is so petty and sad. That you have a group, and I got to say, the majority leader is not exhibiting much leadership here. You're telling me that you can't, and I've read the Senate rules. I teach legislative process. You're telling me by unanimous consent you can't take 10 minutes to give her an up or down vote since you've already had the Judiciary Committee vote on her? That's nonsense. They must want Eric Holder to stay on board. I don't know if they're waiting to find some smoking gun to be able to embarrass the White House more or what, but this is ridiculous.
Mike Miller, you're another card-carrying Republican.
I agree with Pat almost word for word. I am one who believes that the president should get his or her person, unless they're completely incompetent, and I'm convinced by what you tell me that she is a competent person.
Even Rudy Giuliani praised her.
Yeah, I like competence, and I'm never afraid of somebody who's smarter than I am. They make me look good, or they make my work go smoother. So I'm disappointed, and one more day with Eric Holder, that's that's painful. So
John McCain said today that he was still had reservations because she had said that basically she agreed with the president on the executive order, which now a Texas judge is, you know, that is being adjudicated as we speak. But Gloria Borger had a follow-up question, which makes sense. Most of her follow-ups don't. But the one today made sense.
Her head almost exploded today.
And the point is that really, why would an appointee of the attorney general not say that she agreed with the president on this particular issue?
Exactly.
He would have never picked her if she had disagreed with her.
Yeah.
So that's sort of political, makes common sense to me. Let's go to calls.
Then McCain followed up and said, no, I expect the attorney general nominee to tell the truth.
Yeah.
I'm old-fashioned. And she was maybe that's part of the reason for all the politics. He's like, if you agree with this, then I'm not voting for you. I don't agree with this. I think this is an illegal act. And there's an appellate court that did that.
Then the vote and settle the issue.
Vote. More to the point, the fact of the matter is, you know, whether it's an illegal act or not is going to be decided by a court. And if a court says that they can't do it, they're not going to do it.
Okay, then John McCain and the Republicans that think it's illegal have every right to say, we're not going to vote for you.
No, because
we're going to hold you up. We're going to hold you up.
No.
And
no,
so
it's
we
like
figure out whether
hold
or not
you up.
No, what this issue is.
Vote
no,
against her.
No, it's irrelevant.
I have a majority.
One at a time. Patrick.
It is irrelevant to her vote because it's not her call. It's like saying you're a Red Sox fan and I'm not going to vote for you.
Her opinion on a pending issue is not relevant. You should be able to ask her about anything.
No.
Is this
I'm not
relevant?
Saying
do you agree with this? Do you not agree with this? That's a new standard.
Cotter. Pat. She doesn't get to make the call. A court will make the call.
But she can certainly offer an opinion.
You know, if I get to the end of it, I didn't say nobody could ask her. I'm saying that to vote against her for something that she won't get to make the call on is silly.
No, but if she says, and there's a senator like McCain or somebody else that completely disagrees with what the president did, and she says that she agrees with what the president did, then that's totally legitimate questioning for one of these hearings.
I didn't say it was a legitimate question.
It's
I was
legitimate
saying
question. Yes.
That to vote against Pat.
No, but then
Pat,
she says, no, I get what you're saying, but
Pat,
I got to finish the sentence,
so you won't know what to object about. Pat, my point is I never said nobody should ask her. What I'm saying is to suggest that this is a question that is so black and white that you're either – it's so obvious that nobody can have a disagreement about. But particularly in a situation like this where a court is deciding the issue and therefore she will not be able to –
I totally get that.
If she's wrong.
I totally get that, Pat. I totally get that. But you're saying that now McCain says I'm not voting for you. We're not going to call a vote right now. That's somehow not – within
those
their
are,
purview.
Those are two different issues.
Either way, if you want to find out more, then continue the deliberation, or you're just going to vote against her. Either way, he has every right, and every Republican has every right to do that.
Is this politically, last question, from a political standpoint, is this another issue where the Republicans may be losing the public relations battle?
Yep. They've got to go with optics right now.
Let's go to Brian in Roselle, Illinois, listening to us on WCGO, our new flagship station. Go ahead, Brian.
Hey, good afternoon or evening. Back to the ISIL stuff you were talking about before the break. Just a couple things. You know, for the homegrown version, I would hope the NSA and the FBI are all over it. And then what I wanted to comment on was, you know, the country we don't talk about that we need to is Turkey, a NATO ally. And it's the country next door to the ISIS homeland now. And it's the country that all these foreign fighters with Western passports are flowing through to join ISIS. And then they're going to flow out of Iraq and Syria, back through Turkey, and then back out to the world. And I want to hear more discussion about what's going on in Turkey. And then the other thing is we need to control our immigration. We cannot have this loosey-goosey immigration. I'd say anybody that comes from Turkey, Egypt, anywhere from that area, they don't get to come into the United States unless they've gone over with a fine-tooth comb. This idea where we just let people flow around the world willy-nilly, no questions asked, is over.
Well, there's a whole list of countries in the wake of 9/11 that really get more than a single look. I don't know whether I don't think Turkey is on that list, but certainly a number of nations are, Yemen and certainly the obvious nations. But I want to let Philip Beverly, sort of weigh in on this. And obviously there's been a lot of change in Turkey over the last 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, part of the challenge with the Turks is that the Kurds are a major force on the ground, especially in Iraq. And the problems that the Turks have had with the Kurds, getting any kind of cooperation there is really challenging and has to be sort of nuanced. As far as people coming back into the country, as an American passport holder, don't you have to have some kind of grounds to screen me more thoroughly than somebody else? I mean, what's to say that I wasn't an aid worker in Syria working for the Red Cross or Red Crescent coming back to the United States? I mean, there's this sort of one solution to the problem approach isn't ever going to work. We have to be much more nuanced about it.
Mike?
I wonder, though, I understand that Turkey is a wild card in this, but I guess I'm more concerned about Iran. If we're going to pick something other than ISIL, Iran, to me, is always going to be the problem. I think they're the ones that are causing all the destabilization.
Well, I don't think, Brian, you don't disagree with that. You're just saying that you think Turkey needs a little more, closer look than perhaps the media gives it.
I don't think they're pulling their weight. They are a NATO member.
Okay.
And
yeah,
I think we need to lean on them to get their act together, okay, and they can be a force in this fight against ISIS.
We got to pause. 1-800-723-8209. Back shortly from Chicago, and we're going to talk about Aaron Schock.
Thank you. Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton Los Angeles Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. And before the break, I mentioned that we're going to be talking about the resignation of Aaron Schock, 33-year-old bright star in the Republican Party, if you're listening around the country. Someone that never got a lot of Chicago media play, but he certainly got a lot of international media play and certainly Washington, D.C. play. Again, he resigned. And my reaction, I want to turn to Pat Brady, former chairman of the Republican Party. Were you shocked that Schock resigned as quickly as he did?
Yeah, I was. I knew that. I mean, it was all bad. It was drip, 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 bad news, bad news, bad news. When I saw the AP did a story here about some of the real estate deals with donors down there, which got me thinking that's probably enough to make him move on. But he did it quickly. Actually, probably did the Republican Party a favor doing it quickly. But, you know, Aaron is a friend, and I've known him for a long, long time. I grew up in that part of the state, and I feel badly for him. But this is a really bad set of facts. It seems to get worse every day, and he was a bright star in the Republican Party.
Well, by stepping down, the House Ethics Committee stops their investigation, but it triggers the start of a federal investigation. The FBI has already come a-calling. And, Patrick, as someone that has worked with the FBI in the past, usually on one side and maybe now on the other side, is Aaron Schock in big trouble based on what you know in the newspapers?
Well, I want to say something first. I don't see the Aaron Schock thing, frankly, as a very Republican issue. I don't see it as a Democratic issue. It's there's people like this in both parties, and it just assuming for the sake of this discussion, he did some of the things he's accused of. I don't see it as a Republican issue. But having said that, yes, I mean, obviously, he's got any time you get a subpoena from the federal government, you have a problem, and you should call somebody like me. But don't try to handle this on your own, okay? It's like if you find the lump, call a doctor. Don't try to handle it on your own. Yeah, it's a serious, serious problem. I will say this. His resignation, at least to me as a white collar attorney who's advised elected officials who the government was looking at, it rang a bell. And the bell is this. Sometimes I tell clients, I said, you know, as long as you're in office, you are a tremendous, tremendous catch for the government. That's a big one. That's a career maker. I took down a sitting whoever for an FBI agent or an assistant U.S. attorney. Once you're no longer in office, you become not quite such a big catch. So I suppose it's possible that Aaron talked to a very good lawyer, and the lawyer said, well, you know, you could take a little of the pressure off yourself if you were to resign. If you're no longer in office, the heat gets a little less. So that's what came to my mind when I read about Aaron Schock. I thought that's what happened.
Well, the one thing, Pat, be interesting to see what you think about this. It's out of the Springfield Central District U.S. Attorney's Office. It's not out of Main Justice or the Public Integrity Section. And the Springfield U.S. Attorney's Office, very competent, and they work very quickly compared to other districts. So I think that is bad news for Congressman or former Congressman Schock.
Yeah, and I'll echo that. I'll tell you, I have dealt and am currently dealing with that office, and I will tell you they have an extremely aggressive public corruption unit there. And
a lot of grant fraud, a lot of Illinois
grant fraud.
Well, they're in Springfield, and who knows? There could be some wrongdoing down there on occasion.
Oh, Springfield? Casablanca?
Hey, yeah, right. Shocking. But they that is an office known, known for their aggressive anti-public corruption unit. So it's not the office I'd want chasing me if I was in public office.
Mike Miller, again, we're going to ask to get inside Aaron's head at the moment, but why would someone who had so much and such a bright future make such a stupid mistake?
I wish I knew. I deal with a lot of people his age, a lot of MBA students and so forth. And in some ways, they're still, I guess I was when I was 32 or 30, whatever, a little naive, not of the world, not a lot of wisdom. But something is silly. If I understand it correctly, he deducted more miles than his vehicle has on the vehicle. Mm-hmm.
Now Patrick would tell you he drove it backwards.
Odometers are not perfect. I have three good experts I can produce.
What's your cell number?
When necessary to show that odometers get it wrong. I had a Jeep in 1977 that the odometer just stopped working. To make a joke. I mean, we in my business would say, well, that's bad bookkeeping. He just wasn't paying attention to matching up his hours, his miles with what he put in. But no, it's stupid. I think we'd all agree it was just incredibly stupid. The problem is that it is a horrendous lack of judgment that should disqualify you from holding elective office because it's not the money. It's how could you
judgment.
Be so foolish to do something?
Yeah, Hokie Roberts called him an exhibitionist. That's what she said.
Yeah.
And again, so much has been said about the cover of Men's Health magazine by reporters for the last 3 years when it's become public. This is a guy that basically says, look at me, the Instagram, everything else.
Yeah.
There was a level of ego here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also because he was so smart, he had to know how media would play a story if he slipped.
From a political standpoint, I'm glad the Republicans did not rally around him and try to protect him. I think that what was the guy in Alabama named Johnson who had the wads of money in his freezer?
Jefferson.
And for the,
Jefferson.
And for the longest time, they stood beside him when it was clear that he was probably dirty. And I'm just glad the Republicans, when we find somebody we don't like, we throw them out. There are some bad sides. We lost the Senate because of that when we had the guy running against Barack Obama and his wife was Jerry Ryan from...
Just for the record, as a Republican, I have not had my shirt off in public since 1985.
Well, that's good.
Thank you for putting that on the record now.
Make sure
that's
it's
very important.
On behalf of the public, I want to thank you.
You're welcome.
Patrick Cutter, Philip Beverly, and Pat Brady, and Mike Miller. They were all with us in hour number one of Beyond the Beltway this evening. They will all be back for hour number two. And we're gonna talk a little bit about Hillary's email problems. But the bigger, broader question, and we're going to pick up on where we left off with Aaron Schock, is what happens when the FBI or the government knocks on your door? Should you open the door or not? We're going to talk about some process in detail. We've got two former assistant United States attorneys here, white collar in the criminal division, and we're going to hear from them what you should do when the feds knock on your door, or if they knock on your door. Back shortly from Chicago.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Philip Beverly, Pat Brady, Patrick Cotter, and Mike Miller. Our program tonight, coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. And if you want to tweet us a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. Tonight, at least in the next portion of this program, we're going to talk about something that, since we have two former assistant United States attorneys here, I'm going to take advantage of their expertise and ask our other guests to join me in interrogating our guests, I guess, would or have them raise their right hand.
I'm calling Cotter if I get interrogated.
That's what we usually do. We do the interrogation.
Yeah, exactly.
But here's my question. There was the incidence of Aaron Schock. The FBI is going to talk with a former congressman and also friends of Aaron Schock to try to hopefully, in their case, put a case together against Aaron Schock, hopefully for the feds, not necessarily for Aaron Schock. So my question that I ask, because somebody may have to deal with this at some point, when the federal government knocks on your door, Patrick Cotter, what are you obliged to do?
Well, you're obliged not to shoot at them or run or hit them, but you are not obliged to, if you will, speak with them. And that's the most important advice I give everybody. If the government comes around and wants to talk to you, in short, the advice is this. You tell them, who are you? What do you want? You want to talk to me? Okay, will you tell me what this is about? Maybe they will, maybe they won't. And then you say, I would love to talk to you, but I need to consult with my attorney. If you'll leave me your card, I will have my attorney call you, and we will see what we can do. And then you get their card, and then you call your lawyer. That may sound fanciful. It is not. As a matter of fact, it's exactly what most lawyers, judges, and police officers who I've represented do, because they understand how the system works. The mistake most people make is that when the government knocks, they think, I have to talk to them. I have to answer their questions. And that is always, always, always a mistake. Why? There is nothing you can say to them that you can't say just as well and far more safely after vetting it with an attorney who is helping you, as opposed to doing it on the fly with investigators who are not there to help you.
Patrick Brady also joins us, also a former assistant United States attorney working in D.C. and San Diego and Los Angeles. The perception I think that a lot of people have is that if a law enforcement agency, whether it be the FBI or a local police department, comes to see you, they're going to ask you some questions. And if you have nothing to hide, why don't you just cooperate with them?
Because you don't know what they're after, and they're never going to tell you fully. Mm-hmm. So there is no scenario or no situation, Pat laid it out perfectly, where you should talk to them without talking to your lawyer. They're not there to help you.
If they knock on your door.
They're there knocking on your door, they're not there to, unless, like you say, and you, even if they were coming to interview you as a witness, I'd still talk to my lawyer and let the lawyer do the talking for me. You have no idea what documents they have or what preparation they have made before they come talking to you. A lot of times they don't come talking to you until very, very late in the game, and they know exactly what they have, and it does you no good to say anything. For a lot of reasons. First of all,
on the TV shows, I mean, when the police officers show up on the TV shows, people, they tend to start telling little stories.
And always at the end of the show, they're found guilty.
That's true. So those one-hour dramas really could be 5-minute dramas. Right? They don't have to be stretched.
Right. I think it's important to note that the government is under no obligation to be honest with you about why they're there or what they're trying to do or who the target is or anything. As long as they're just talking to you, they haven't placed you under arrest, they don't have to give you your rights. They could just ask you whatever they want.
Plus,
they can lie
also,
to you.
Patrick, this may be a little bit of a stretch, but they can actually make up stuff.
Absolutely.
None of it has to be true what they're telling you.
Oh, absolutely. It happens all the time. And that's not illegal. I'm not suggesting it's wrong. I'm saying that's the way it is. And that's why you are never making the right choice when you talk to them.
So, Philip Everly.
So they don't have to put it in terms of this is a hypothetical.
Nope.
Oh, absolutely. No, no, no. We have a witness who saw you coming out of the bank at 2 p.m. on Wednesday. What do you have to say about that? They don't have a witness. Nobody saw anything. They just want to see what your reaction will be.
You seemed a little startled by these revelations.
I agree that you don't have to speak. I thought that would – I mean, the Fifth Amendment and everything. But I guess many of my colleagues wonder at the university – I'm a conservative. Why am I, in a sense – I don't want to say anti-government. Why am I so cynical or so protective against the government? And this is exactly why. That I fear that the government will use its power, and it'll use it poorly, to take down the common people. And that there are rules.
Political opponents.
Exactly. And not that we've gotten into this already, but with Hillary Clinton and the emails, the fact that she didn't sign this form that everybody else has to sign, I become even more and more cynical that there are rules for one group of people, and then there's rules for all of the rest of us, and you can step on me like a bug. And I I'm not being naive. I'm 61 years old. I understand what you're saying, and I hope they never knock on my door. I would do exactly what you said. But you know, I resent that. I have to be that protective against the power to incarcerate me.
Pat Brady.
You know, it's funny you say that as a conservative, too. This is where I completely changed my support for the death penalty about 17, 18 years ago, because I don't believe the government is competent to call balls and strikes on life and death.
You and I are in the same ballpark.
And it's not even that I believe maybe the rightness or wrongness of doing it. I just don't believe the government's competent to do it.
Exactly. I agree 100%. I'm against the death penalty, partly for religious reasons, but also because I believe the government has no right to take a life like
Phil
that.
Phil Beverly.
So it's what Pat was saying is exactly what I tell my students. When you have dealings with the police, you don't talk to them until you have an attorney present. You just don't.
But you do as they say, right? There's two issues, okay? If they're knocking on your door and they're looking for information, that's one way. I mean, you've given the advice that people should have if that's police departments as well as the FBI or any investigative agency. That is different from a police officer telling someone to walk on the sidewalk or to disperse, though. I mean, that's. Do you see the difference there?
Because yeah. And
in that case, they should follow the police direction, right?
And what I say is you don't have to, and there's consequences if you don't. So if the police officer tells you and you choose to do something else, understand there's going to be consequences for that. But you don't have to do what they say, and you don't get to be mad if there's cuffs put on you.
Roughly.
Well, there are very few gentle ways to put cuffs on, that at least in my experience. But I want to make a couple points. First of all, I always tell clients, and by the way, I actually write policies, and it's entitled "What to Do When the Government Knocks on Your Door." And one of the first rules is, of course, you have to obey their orders. If they tell you to move aside, if they say we're coming in, you do not fight
them.
Fine. You do not resist.
Not a problem.
But you don't have to cooperate. And the other thing is, frankly. I would say that I understand that law enforcement has a very difficult job to do. I understand they have to ask questions. I'm not against them asking questions. I just think that people need to understand their constitutional rights and understand that you very well may decide to help them and cooperate after you talk to your lawyer.
We're going to be back with more questions, including email, back shortly.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and we're continuing our discussion and getting good legal advice, I think, from our two former U.S. attorneys, assistant United States attorneys, and Patrick Cotter is now one of the top defense attorneys in the United States, or certainly in the city of Chicago. And again, if you tuned in, he's the guy that, as a federal prosecutor in the strike force in New York, he's the guy that got the conviction on John Gotti. So he's got a big fish, and now he's on the other side representing those charged with crimes, or at least giving advice. And I want to get another reaction, because you talked about what happens when the FBI or the police agency knocks on your door. I want to get reaction from you as to, in the wake of the Hillary Clinton email issues, what happens to your email, and how secure is your email? And when you delete something, is it really deleted? And is it believable to you that Hillary Clinton could really lose or delete 32,000 emails?
Well, I'll tell you what I tell clients, which is that people need to get a more mature understanding of what an email is. An email, we treat email and texting as though it's just chatting with people. It is as permanent and as important as any letter that you ever dictated and had signed. And it exists forever. It will probably be around long after that letter is gone. So I always tell my clients that there are lots of people in jail because of emails they wrote. There's lots of people indicted because of emails they wrote. And emails are incredibly important. As far as Hillary Clinton and her 32,000 or yep, whatever it is, emails, I hope to God there was nothing in there that she didn't want anybody to read, because they exist. I guarantee you that. Those emails are somewhere, and they're going to be found, and someone, not me, but someone's going to read them. So trying to destroy emails is just foolish.
But where are they? Explain to us technologically, where are they? If you delete 32,000 emails, as you say, and by the way, between now and the time the American people will vote in 2016, somebody will probably find those, and you say go through them and release them selectively, just as she obviously deleted them selectively. So that's a big piece of news. But are they kept? Well, is it on the cloud somewhere?
Well, I'm not. It could be. I'm not a technical expert. I, thank God, hire young, bright people to do that for me. But as I understand it, and as I've experienced it in a lot of cases I have had over the last several years, where email is almost always an enormous part of the case, there are backup systems built into every modern computer system. Every modern computer. But even if you're in a system like the State Department, they have backups and backups and backups for the backups. And deletion really is just, as I understand it, it's just a way of getting it sort of off your desk so that you can get more new emails and do your job. That's what it's designed to do. But the backups are there. Right. It's convenience. It doesn't make it go away. So those – now, yes, if you hire some – really, really bright young hacker kid, they might be able to actually destroy an email so that nobody can get it. But if you're in a system, the idea that you've deleted it and it's no longer available, that's just a fantasy.
Philip Beverly, how big is this issue for Hillary Clinton? And can it – could it sink her campaign?
No, it doesn't – I don't think it sinks it. I think it's one of those – and here's something else that we can't trust about Hillary.
Unless, of course, you get into the 32,000 emails.
Right. If there's a smoking gun in the deleted emails, that could sink her. But
what do you think?
I don't imagine that there's anything
there's
significant.
There's no emails
in there
on Benghazi Day, before Benghazi Day, after Benghazi Day. There is this period of time in the most important day when she was Secretary of State, incident when she was Secretary of State, and those are not available.
And so it
is
may
that
be
believable.
Maybe
Mike?
It's the
no,
18 minutes
no
of missing, missing
well,
audio
it's,
from
it's
Nixon.
More than eight. Well, that's
right. It's the same thing.
That sunk his presidency. Go ahead.
I would have rather had her win in 2008 than Barack Obama. And I think in retrospect, maybe I would have been better off had she won. The lack of transparency, the whole idea that she has her own server, that she was supposed to sign this form, but if she did sign it, she clearly committed perjury because she had these things on her server that she knew about and didn't turn them over until 2 years after the fact. If she didn't sign it, why? What makes her so special? And now that everybody knows about it, she says, you're not getting my server. To have somebody like this be the president of the United States bothers me. I don't get it. Do we need four more years of that kind of nonsense that existed?
Well, Pat Brady, I know your answer is no to that question.
No, but
so I want to talk about following up on what Patrick Cotter had to say, and that is just the fact that these emails will never be lost. So who would be looking for them? It would seem to me that the Koch brothers would be hiring one of these bright young people that you're talking about. Or some foreign country, the Saudi family, would be looking for these things.
Or the Russians.
Or the Russians, or anyone else, because it is possible that there is blackmailable information in those deleted emails.
Sure, but I'm not going to be a technology guy, but it's the difference. You said they aren't State Department emails. They're off her server.
Right. Right. That's a good
point.
So
until that server, somebody gets a look at that server, right, they might not be found.
Well, that's been subpoenaed
sent an email to somebody
I was just going
to
say.
That's a hard way to do it.
It is a hard way to do it, but believe me, having had to defend people where the government did it in much less important, where the stakes were a lot lower than this, it was just some alleged fraud. The fact of the matter is, and this is something I tell people, and no one listens to me, but I tell my clients over and over, I said, every email you send goes somewhere, and wherever it goes, it's still there. Yeah. Even if you take your server and you go out in the dead of a night and you take your hammer and you smash it into teeny little bits.
That's only half of it.
You've only destroyed one copy of the email. There is still a whole copy of everything you wrote, and it's out there. And once the government knows, they will start to find it.
What was also frightening was her comment that she figured it was a secure server because the Secret Service was outside her house protecting her house.
Yeah,
as though that's what protected that server. That naivete is frightening. Absolutely frightening.
I would challenge you. I don't think it's naive at all. I don't think Hillary has ever been naive. No. She is very calculating.
Yes.
And there is a circumvention of the rules here.
Would you stop helping, please? Because you, as a Democrat at the table,
I gotta tell you, she's not my favorite, and I think I'd rather have a James Webb.
Point is, by saying she is thinking that someone, all they have to do is to go in there and physically get the server, and the Secret Service are protecting. So if the server is there, nobody's had access to it. It's like here's a 67-year-old woman who doesn't know anything about hacking
technology.
Bruce, can I say?
And
this?
By the way, I can say that she's 67 years old because I am 70 years old.
Okay,
so that's within the statute of limitations.
And had she had her emails on Gmail or something, which are really secure systems,
Hotmail.
I would have been much.
Should be on Hotmail.
Right, I'd have been much more secure with that. Then she had it on her own server that could easily be hacked.
Yeah, here's a point I think needs to be made. I think one of the things that this whole experience, this episode, I think is going to highlight, and I hope something good comes out of it, is that this country needs to figure out what we're going to do with email and texting. Because here's the problem. The law, and when an issue comes up, we treat those texts and emails that they are every bit as reliable, important, real as any letter, any edict, any charter ever signed by anybody in the world. And yet, how do we as individuals, and particularly the young people, how do they treat them? They treat them like burping. I mean, it means nothing. They just do it. It's stream of consciousness. People write emails that they don't mean. People write emails that they are kidding about.
Yep.
People write emails because they're – and I've had clients tell me this. I was just trying to get their attention. And I say, congratulations. The DOJ is paying attention because we treat emails – And I think this Hillary story is a great example. Hillary doesn't understand what an email really is. She doesn't understand where it goes. She doesn't understand how long it lasts. And it's not just Hillary. It's millions of people in this country.
Here's the bigger back to the political point. This is a very accomplished woman who has admitted publicly she hasn't driven a car since 1996. Yeah. She has lived in a bubble like nobody's business. Her problem politically, I don't think it's going to be the email issue. It's going to be the fact that she can't relate to anybody because she hasn't been one of us for a long, long time.
Yeah, I will tell you, I feel bad for Hillary tonight because she's not my favorite either, and we're the Democrats on the panel.
Well, this is the big divide because she does have a problem with the, and this is why you see what's going on here with the. And you know, throughout the country, with the far left of the Democrat Party.
Well, the Elizabeth Warren.
The Boston Globe has urged Elizabeth Warren to run for president.
Hillary is here, right? Very high. Elizabeth Warren gets in. It's going to be a bigger drop for them this time on the left than it will be for somebody like Ted Cruz that doesn't have a chance this year. The Republicans aren't going to be fighting that the far right. Like the Democrats can be fighting.
I want to go back to the, you know, the where this stuff goes once you delete it, because you say the Justice Department can start looking at it. What does the Justice Department need before they can start looking for the emails of a target? And literally, where do they go? Where do they go to get this information? You say you're is it again? I asked you the cloud. You say you're not the technical guy.
I'm not the technical
guy. We need a 23-year-old hacker around the table to answer that question.
That's exactly.
But again,
I will tell you this.
Legally, where do they go?
Here's what I've experienced. The government will try to identify, first of all, the individuals that were regularly receiving emails from her. They will try to identify individuals who are regularly receiving emails from her. Shouldn't be that hard. And then they will go to them, and they will first ask, hey, can we look at the emails?
Oh, sure.
Some of them will give them. Some of them, because they didn't call me, will answer their questions and will turn them over. Others, they will simply say, okay, John Jones got a lot of emails from Hillary because of his position. What server is John Jones on? And then they will get a subpoena and they will go to that server and they say, give me all John Jones's emails between him and Hillary.
We got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Back shortly from Chicago. Sick of wading through social media, papers, and nightly news to get your Chicago political scoop? Subscribe to AlderTrack instead. It's got a weekday newsletter with original reporting on all 50 aldermen, top city agencies, administrative commissions, their staff, and more. It's my go-to source for news, raw data, and council tidbits first thing in the morning. If you subscribe to AlderTrack.com before April 7th, you'll get 10% off. Get AlderTrack now, or you'll be missing out when the new council begins.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for the new Wild Travels series, Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 10:30 p.m., on WTTW Channel 11.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us around the roundtable this evening. We have four great guests, and Patrick Cotter will tell us a little bit more about your background, Patrick.
Well, thank you, Bruce.
You've given us all this great legal advice.
Well, as you may have guessed, I'm an attorney. I'm with a firm here in Chicago called Greensfelder, and I've been doing that for about, 18 years in private practice. Before that, I was with the Department of Justice, and I was with the Strike Force on Organized Crime in New York. So that's my practice is primarily white collar. I advise individuals and corporations who, frankly, are having interactions with the federal government.
I want to ask you a follow-up question to you. You've been on the prosecution side, and now you're on the defense side. What prompted the switch?
You know, people ask that. It's a very natural question to ask. I honestly believe that it's not really such a switch. I mean, we're both absolutely required and necessary to the justice system. Without defense attorneys, there is no justice system. Without prosecutors, there is no justice system. We're both serving a role, and they're both honorable roles and important roles. For me, it was just a question of I frankly sort of felt I had gone as far as I could go as a federal prosecutor. I had some pretty good success. I didn't think I was ever – the day after the Gotti verdict, I said, I'm never getting a bigger case, and I decided I wanted to do something different.
Did one give you more satisfaction than the other?
No, they're different satisfactions. I mean, the thing about being a federal prosecutor is you have tremendous power. And it's a burden, but it's also, to be blunt, it's pretty exhilarating. And for a young guy to have that kind of power to convene a grand jury, to bring federal charges, to stand up in court and say, I represent the United States of America, that's pretty heady stuff. On the other hand, as a defense attorney, there's something really wonderful about standing up against the government of the United States and saying, I'm here for my guy, Bill. And he's my guy, and I'm going to defy you, government. You're wrong. You're making a mistake. I'm going to get justice for Bill. And that's a pretty heady thing, too.
Mike Miller also judges. You like that second part of his discussion.
Oh, yes. Yeah, very much the case. And
not that you're under indictment.
No, I am not.
But you know you're going to call if ever.
May you never need me.
Yes. Well, economists, you know, we're so bad at forecasting. We'll probably be bad at dealing with the feds as well. But I'm an economist at DePaul. I've been there 35 years, and I'm a product of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Well done.
Philip Beverly.
Thanks, Bruce. I'm an associate professor of political science at Chicago State University and an ardent defender of First Amendment freedoms.
Patrick Brady, a former assistant United States attorney.
Yes, I just used my advocacy skills differently and got into politics, founder of Next Generation Group. We do lobbying and media relations, and so, yeah, it's all good.
And who do you lobby for? Is that a
whole bunch
secret?
Of people. Okay. Not a secret, but clients.
That's okay.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
Let's go to Greg listening to us in Schaumburg, Illinois, on our flagship station, WCGO AM 1590. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. I'm a geeky 60-year-old who would like to challenge each of you, and I won't send you a bill, but you really do need to get a little bit more astute on just the sheer technical aspect of email and how things are saved. And if I could just give you this one 30-second example.
Sure.
An individual made the comment before that when you delete something, it's effectively sort of deleting it off your hard drive. It really isn't. Think about the old days of records, you know, standard records, you know, vinyl records. The way a file is saved is in sectors, and let's just say it's got 8 cars, like of a train. What effectively it does, it just knocks out the engine. Everything else that is there is gone. It's the identifying part of it, the engine, which is telling you where everything else is on that drive, which if you looked on your drive and saw FAT32, that's file allocation table 32, and there's other ways to do it, too, from a standpoint. But if you guys, sitting down with a client, just explained this much to somebody, drew 3 circles and said, drew 8 squares, say you've only knocked out the first box and all the rest of them are there and we can put it all back together again, then you've made your point.
Yeah, that's why if you ever get rid of a computer, you should always destroy the hard drive, correct? Because those sectors, even if you've erased them, you've not erased them.
Right. And if I could make one more point, Bruce, is that you guys probably are not familiar with the significance of the hashtag or any kind of string search capability. But when you were talking about the servers, particularly as it relates to the Internet, think of the world, you know, like a globe out in space and all these servers and stuff like that. That whole thing is searchable by a string search thing like a hashtag. Mm-hmm. In other words, if we wanted to say, you know, Bruce BTB, you know, and everybody goes on and bombs the Internet at 6 o'clock on Sunday night, that would be trending. We'd be able to find all the people that, you know, put BTB on. Mm-hmm. So it's really, really important you guys get up to speed on this.
I either that or hire a 16-year-old. I think no.
You can tell him about the 80s.
Greg. By the way, Greg, one of the great things that I enjoy more about these 2 hours that I spend every Sunday night is that, you know, we try to have 4 smart guests here. They're smart in specific areas. They are not necessarily smart in every area. But the greatness of talk radio is that there are people that are out there who, frankly, in many areas are smarter than we. And I appreciate those like yourself who call up to share your knowledge so we know a little bit more and people listening to this program know a little bit more. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks. Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much. Philip, I want to get your assessment because, you know, we're talking about what happens when the FBI knocks on your door. But one other aspect of the criminal justice system that is very near and dear to your heart is the over-incarceration that we have in this country. And recently I made a big point on this program that you have in the last several months, you have the Koch brothers and you have George Soros and you have groups that are left of center and right of center. They are joining together to create a new force in politics that is going to revolutionize and change and reform the criminal justice system. So it's one of the most powerful groups that's been able to come together, and there may be some significant changes being made. And I'm wondering, with all the things in your view that you think is wrong with the criminal justice system, where should they start?
I would say you've got to look at sort of the demographics of the incarcerated and start looking at drug laws, especially for nonviolent offenders. I can envision this sort of critical mass eventually being reached around marijuana laws in the country, and eventually the feds are going to have to take marijuana off the Schedule I from the Controlled Substances Act. They're going to have to do that because it's just it doesn't make any sense. And then you can then focus more on the real drug problems. Meth is a huge problem, and we have to be able to address that. Cocaine is still a huge problem. Maybe we want to start thinking about medicalizing heroin like it was at the turn of the last century. Keeping people out of prison, bringing price down, taking the crime element out of heroin. There are a lot of high-functioning heroin addicts out there. I mean, let's just admit that. And let's start treating it like the disease I think that it is.
Mike Miller, you're an economist. You look at everything, you know, through the prism of economics. Mm-hmm. What about the economics of our over-incarceration in this country?
Oh, I think it's devastating that, especially with the recidivism rate, you're taking a lot of human capital and you're stuffing it into prisons for stuff that is nonviolent. And I've never used this may seem strange at my age of 61 that I was in the 60s and 70s. I never have once used anything, even marijuana, not even once. But it absolutely should be legalized, and we've got to get rid of the war on drugs the way it's fought. But there's one thing you had mentioned as being a prosecutor, how you like, you know, when people do bad things, you put them away. There was a story of a friend of the family or whatever where he did some dumb things as a very young man, and he was offered. He could bring other people in. The prosecutors essentially said, bring them in too, and I'll get more scalps, and I can put more people in jail, and you'll get less time. And he said, no, I won't do this because they didn't do anything. It's all on me. I did. But they purposefully tried to get as many scalps as they could because that would look good for them. And I resent that. I think that's a horrible thing.
Is that standard operating procedure?
I wouldn't call it standard operating procedure. I think that any system that is set up as a criminal prosecution system that's how they keep score. How well are we doing? Are we putting people away? Are we getting convictions? I used to always joke when I was a prosecutor that I won some awards for putting people in jail. I never got an award for dismissing a case or closing out an investigation because there wasn't enough evidence to go forward.
Why would you get an award for offering to someone who has already told you that I did it myself? Why would you even make an offer then to try to destroy another life?
Right. Well, first of all, they may not they may not believe the young man. Yeah. That's first, because invariably when you approach somebody who's in an organized or any kind of – I use organized crime in a group, their inclination is not to implicate others. So they're going to say, no, it was just me. But the other thing is, look, where there's great power, there's the potential for great abuse. Federal prosecutors and all prosecutors have a great deal of power, as I alluded to earlier, and there's going to be abusive situations. But it does not follow necessarily that simply because you go to somebody who's been caught themselves and try to say, look, if we can get five other – this guy is most likely to know other people doing this. If he can get five other people who are doing it, we'll have done a good thing for law enforcement. There are abuses where sometimes you're asking them to go after innocent people.
You know, one follow-up question I didn't ask you in the last segment when you were explaining the process. When are you read your Miranda rights, or when are you supposed to be read your Miranda rights?
You're not entitled to your Miranda rights until you are in custody. You have to be in custody. In other words, you no longer have the freedom to terminate the interview, walk away, or leave. Then and only then, if they choose to question you, then they must give you Miranda rights. But if they simply arrest you and don't want to talk to you, they don't ever have to give
Miranda
rights. Or
if they're coming in and just asking questions in sort of a friendly way.
Or they leave the door open in the detective's room.
That's right, yeah.
That's when you should call the attorney.
That's when you should call the attorney.
Don't say we're here from the government and we're here to help. Don't believe it. Back shortly from Chicago.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Bruce Dumont, we're back on the air, and boy, what a great discussion we had during the commercial break. We got to put some of it on the record here. Patrick Brady, you were making a point about where you start to reform the criminal justice system, and you made a very revealing statement.
Well, I agree with everything you said about the – I don't necessarily agree on the drug laws, but the one place that I think badly needs reform here where we sit and across the country is in the grand jury process. You know, when I was a young prosecutor or assistant state's attorney or a federal prosecutor, I went to the grand jury to get subpoenas to go get these documents or do whatever I needed to do. And that process, the two problems we had in the last two or three years with the real kind of racially sensitive cases, Ferguson and Staten Island, those were grand juries. And now Ferguson's a little different because I think the prosecutor did the right thing and revealed everything they did. But this grand jury process puts a lot of power with very little oversight into what the prosecutor is doing, and that needs to be reformed because it's outdated. It goes back to the old English common law, and I don't think there's enough oversight right now.
Where would you start the reforms, Patrick?
I think that's an excellent place to start it. I think the grand jury long ago outlived its usefulness. I think what we should have is a system where prosecutors have to go to a truly impartial and actually informed person, a judge.
Well, expound. Sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead.
But the informed nature of the grand jury, yeah. Not that they're not all great people.
Some of them are far smarter than I'll ever be. The problem is that a grand jury is a bunch of civilians who are picked almost at random. They are put in a room, and they are only told exactly no more and no less than what the prosecutor wants them to hear. No one else speaks to them. There's no other voice. There's no countervailing person. There's no arbiter. They hear and are shown and told exactly what the prosecutor wants them to hear. Most prosecutors in this country, I believe, are honorable, good people who are in this for the right reasons, and they don't try to abuse the grand jury. But when you've got a system where there's no check on that kind of power, the power that can destroy a person, a company, simply by initiating an investigation – you can destroy a company. Their stock can plummet just because they got a bunch of subpoenas.
And it's all supposed to be secret.
And it's all supposed to be secret. And the beauty part of it, if you're the prosecutor, is no one can ever question what you did in there. No one can ever know what you said or didn't say, what you showed them, what you didn't show them. No one ever knows, including the person who ends up being indicted because of that grand jury and who ends up going to trial and maybe to jail. They will never find out what happened in the grand jury. And that's
why. I wonder why some of us are so
skeptical.
So skeptical of government. I know that is constitutionally I have to be protected from you. So we need a police and we need a court system and so forth. But, man, I'm going home awfully down after this.
Drive carefully.
Yeah, I will. Yeah, yeah.
Don't get pulled over.
Well, the thing is,
I don't want to get pulled over.
The system's only as good as the people that are in it. And I do believe that most people really try to do the right thing. But you get to a point in a grand jury where you're in there every day. I need to get these indictments, especially at this. I think it's more abused at the state level than the federal level.
But I want to go back again to something else. We could do a whole another couple of shows just on this subject. But your point about I'm going back to the emails, Hillary's emails or anybody's emails. At what point either does the government or some private entity who knows the technology of this, can they start snooping on every email that has been sent? We know that the NSA can listen in and read everything that we want. But what about private entities?
Well,
political opponents.
You know, somebody once said that nobody ever built a bank vault that some other guy didn't figure out how to break open. And right now, we all spend our lives sending emails and doing things on the computer, and we believe that they're all somehow protected, that there are all these protections. And we've all learned over the last few years that there are very, very smart, clever people all over the world who spend all day, every day, figuring out how to break in and look at that stuff.
But there's the operative word, break in. It's still against the law.
It still gets the law. But the fact of the matter is, I think that the technology is so new that we just haven't quite figured out how to make it safe yet. But because it's so cool and neat and useful, we all go ahead and use it anyway.
Is our cyber future and our cyber security? Are you more fearful of that than an act of terrorism in the broader sense?
Well, I would say this: I'm far more likely to be a victim of that than I ever am to be a victim of terrorism in the traditional
violent
sense,
right?
Violence.
Yeah.
I'm far more likely to.
So the Sony issue is an issue that is extremely significant and something we're going to have to deal with on a very broad base for a long, long time.
As a society.
And we're behind.
We're way behind other nations.
Chairman Rogers, former head of the House Intelligence Committee, gave a speech here a couple months ago that I went to, and he went through this, and it is, you listen to him talk, it is very scary. We've been behind for a long, long time, and we're getting further behind every day.
Yeah.
Who's ahead?
I think the Chinese.
They've got many more people and resources dedicated.
And it's not even stealing intellectual property. It's the ability to completely destroy our economy.
Shut down our electrical grid,
shut down the financial system.
Yeah. Their capacity to do that is far greater, I think, than ours. And our ability to defend against it, I think, is far less.
But those charged with protecting us are our elected officials, are the structures, are the establishment, are the justice system, are the prosecutors, are the police. They are there to protect us and serve us. And yet we're hearing tonight that many times they abuse their powers. And just because you think that the person knocking on your door is wearing a white hat and you've watched 30 or 40 years of television and you know that when the police show up, they're there to help you. And in many cases, they are. And we certainly don't want to in any way suggest that the policemen don't want to help you. But again, when you get that knock on the door, either from the police or from the federal government or the FBI, which has great PR...
Call Cotter.
Well, call Cotter.
Call somebody.
Welcome back, Mr. Cotter. Because
saying earlier, call Saul or something.
That's right.
Call somebody who knows what they're doing.
That's right. But don't when they say I'm here from the government and I'm here to help you, question them and call your lawyer. And not question them. Call your lawyer first. Our time is up for this evening. Patrick Cotter, thank you very much. Patrick Brady, thank you very much. Mike Miller. And Philip Beverly, we thank you all for being with us tonight on Beyond the Beltway. Thanks to Dylan Plowkey for his assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions.
Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.